This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Okay, so we're writing another story. Go ahead.
Right.
Give us the details.
It's impossible for her to have slept with her husband, and it's awful. It's impossible for her not to have committed adultery, but you don't have any witnesses. You don't have two witnesses again.
You see, I want to say yes. I want to affirm and also distance myself from the direction of your question. What I want to agree with is it looks like there were very stringent standards of legal evidence in the Old Testament. And as I was telling you privately last week, I think we really need Christian lawyers and people interested in law to do some study of this, to find out how it would have operated. What did two witnesses mean? One writer, Mr. Rush Dooney, that you've been reading, maintains that one witness amounts to circumstantial evidence, that what is called witness, quote-unquote, in the Hebrew, could also stand for evidence. And so the circumstantial evidence is one witness. Then you have one other witness that might put the person at the scene of the crime or see them holding the smoking gun or what have you. And so you would have the two witnesses. Is that right or wrong? I don't know. That may be right. That may be wrong. What we need is somebody who's going to do some study of this with a good knowledge of the Bible and good knowledge of legal procedures and standards and come up with some guides on these sorts of things. And so in that sense, I want to affirm what you're getting at. It does seem like we just kind of assume that the practice of law today is what the practice of the law would have been under the system of God's law. On the other hand, I want to distance myself from the direction of your question by pointing out that it's true that some crimes will get off scot-free. Some criminals will get off scot-free. And it's probably true that even under your scenario, that we all would have known Bathsheba was an adulteress, but since we couldn't prove it, she wouldn't have been punished. For Christians, that's awkward to swallow because we know the standard of justice on the final day is going to be perfect. You know, not one, you know, thing is going to be out of place then. One of the toughest things that we have to learn to live with is the imperfection of justice in this, our own day, in history. We have to grant that some people, to treat them according to their rights means that they will get off for things that we just in our heart of hearts know. But remember, it's in our heart of hearts. If you cannot prove the man to be guilty, you have no right to take away his life. Because, and by the way, just think of the alternative. Once you give up that principle, once you give up the principle of definite concrete proof, just because you know this person's guilty after all, I'm talking about the reign of terror and anarchy. When people, you know, what distinguishes kidnapping from imprisonment, murder from execution, stealing from fining? The rule of law. You see, I can come and I can kidnap you and put you in a place and lock you up and treat you just like you were in a prison, but it will never be legally a prison because it's my doing it apart from the rule of law. My doing it on the basis of whim is what it amounts to, rather than on due process and proof. When the state does it on the basis of pre-established law and proof, then it amounts to legal punishment. Outside of that, it's illegal. So anyway, it's probably true that Bathsheba would have gotten off without a civil punishment in the Old Testament. That's right.
I'd just like to point out from my observation a little bit that they figure, what, maybe 5% of all the crimes maybe go to court. About
today, you mean?
Yeah, about maybe 60% of those are convictions. So that puts us down to what, about
2 or 3%?
And from what I've seen, if we had to go where there were two witnesses, that would knock it down to about maybe 5 or 10% of those people that we have convicted now. So we're talking about, I think, less than 1% of the criminals being convicted in the way our society is now.
Let me rewrite it now. Let's say the law of God were the law of the land. You wouldn't have your 5% going to court. You'd have like 95% going to court. If the law of God were the law of the land, there'd be a lot of changes made. You see, what you're doing is you're beginning with one system, the practice of law, which I can understand. I have concern for it too. But you begin with that system, and then you import just a few of the principles from another system, and that seems to, you know, cut it down. What I'm asking for, you see, is we shift over to this whole system of law over here, And when you do that, there's going to be a lot of changes made. In the first place, the law of hue and cry, as Rush Jenny calls it. You know, you're not going to have people who will not testify against criminals are guilty of the crime that they would not testify against. And so, I mean, you're going to improve the legal evidence in one sense because you're going to have people who are under obligation to go to court against people who are known criminals and all the rest. Moreover, you're going to have very stiff penalties so that people, I believe, really will be deterred from doing, not completely, I'm not talking about perfection on earth, but I believe there's going to be a great deal of deterrence of crime, and there are going to be a lot of things changed. And because of those changes, I don't know that the percentages will come out to where you are. Secondly, we have to ask ourselves, what are the two witnesses? What kind of requirement is that? Does that mean two eyewitnesses in the way that you're assuming in your illustration or not? Is Rush Dooney right? I don't know. I do know this, that the God of all the earth will not make any mistakes. And so whatever the two witnesses are, that's what we should be doing. Let me take the extreme example. I don't believe this. But let's assume that it does have to be the two eyewitnesses, and the only way around this is that we've got to live a lot more communally. Okay? You don't walk out on the street by yourself, you know, you don't do all sorts. I mean, you live in the kind of circumstance where, for the most part, there always will be two witnesses, unless you happen to be walking in the field, you know, as, and a woman gets raped out there, or something like that. For the most part, you watch out for those situations. Let's say it calls for a radical change in our lifestyle. The question would become, which is better, impugning the law of God or changing our lifestyle radically? And I'd say at that point, we'd better change our lifestyle. I'm not saying that that is what is required. All I'm saying is the stakes are so high here that we've got to endorse the law of God no matter what men may say. But now we've got to find out what the law of God says, and I don't presume to know all those answers. Let God be true, though all men are liars, I guess, is the spirit of that answer. And I'm not going to impugn the law of God, even if it becomes awkward to follow the law of God. I'm going to take one more question, then I've got to finally get you a break, and we'll take a good long one today and come back for our last session.
How much would the freedom of the individual change from one system to another? It seems I've been taught that people have freedom to write or read anything that they want to print or is printed. And yet, I feel that pornography and other kinds of material like this is definitely wrong. And I just wonder where the balance comes in.
I think genuine freedom in society is the freedom to live as God wants us to live. And consequently, there are some things which are honorifically called freedoms today, which when removed under a godly society, will not genuinely reduce the freedom of men, will only reduce what they conceive to be their freedoms. I don't deny that I'm on a head-on collision with those who believe that, you know, as a libertarian society, we can do anything we want to do as long as we don't hurt others. Or, to put it another way, I believe we ought not to do anything that'll hurt others, but I happen to think that some of the things you don't think hurt others, hurt others. For instance, I believe it is a definite, has damaging effects on our society to allow pornography, homosexuality, abortion, and all the rest. So I could argue that way. But in terms of the immediate effect, I grant somebody looking at Playboy magazine is not doing damage to his neighbor. I mean, it's not as though he's going over and shooting his neighbor by doing that. It doesn't have that very immediate damage to his neighbor. This is long-term and generalized damage to his society and its moral fabric and whatever metaphors you want to use of that nature. So I'm on a head-on collision there. That's true. I believe in freedom of religion. I don't believe people are punished for being unbelievers. I don't believe they're punished for being idolaters in their heart of hearts and all that. But I do believe that idolatry, when openly practiced, is subversive of the moral standards of the society. And therefore, for the society's well-being, it must punish those who would lead people to follow other gods. Remember I said it's not a question of which whether you'll follow God in society. It's a question of which God you'll follow. And no society in the history of man is able to follow all gods simultaneously. Our society is going to eventually punish people for following wrong gods. But what our society conceives to be wrong gods will unfortunately include Jehovah of the Old Testament, if we Christians are not careful. Well, let's take a 10-minute break and come back, and I'll try to... Dr. Kikasola wants to start out with a question.
I would like to raise a question about the apple sorting with which we began earlier in the class today, the so-called picking of good and bad laws. In the list you gave us there, I would like to make this observation and have you reflect on it, Dr. Botson. I'm looking down that list, and I can see how most Christians would accept everything that you have listed there on the blackboard as indeed being not only sinful, but criminal and punishable and reprehensible. But notice they would qualify, again, I'm generalizing, most Christians would make once some qualification on the open pit in the goring ox. For example, there they would say, obviously, that's reprehensible, they should be punished, but not the death penalty, because they would see it as other than first degree or second degree or something else. And then coming down the list, farmers, the rest on the Sabbath, in the years that I've taught the Pentateuch, I've noticed that just about everyone will grant you, it is sinful, it is criminal to force a man to work 7 days a week.
Right.
But then when you advocate the penalty, the penal sanction that God has advocated for that, namely death, then they flinch indeed. And then you come a little further down to executing murderers, and it's there where you get much less unanimity among Christians. Most Christians that I, if I get my generalize, are for capital punishment in the case of capital crimes. But some Christians would say, in the name of consistency about the ox and about the Sabbath, maybe we ought not to take human life, something like life imprisonment or something like that.
Okay. The first question about the open pit and the goring ox.
Yeah.
The suggestion was you don't have here first-degree murder, after all, and so it's wrong to take their life. What I'd say is that a man who commits second-degree murder or manslaughter, and does so twice, knowingly, has committed first-degree murder. That is, third-degree murder becomes first-degree murder when one willingly perpetrates a situation or allows a situation to continue, a circumstance that takes away the life of an innocent person. The difference is, of course, that he didn't sit down and plot which person it was going to be. But the fact is that if I'm polluting, let's say my industry is putting contaminants into the air, all right, and we assume there's some ill effects, but we don't know how bad they are, and it turns out that it's killing little children in the neighborhood, okay? And then we find out about that, and we make the financial restitution, you know, that can be made, that hardly takes away the grief of the parents and all that, but you do what you can. And then the next day we go down there and we just put the contaminants into the air again. That's first-degree murder, because now you know what it's doing to people, and although you didn't plot that it would kill the Jones child and the Smith child, the fact is any child that dies as a result of what you did, knowingly that you've got a dangerous situation, I think it's perfectly just that you be put to death for doing that. And that's what the open pit and goring oxen laws have to do with.
And one of the ethics courses that I've taken has gone into corporate ethics.
Right.
You know, when you have a corporation doing, you know, making a decision like this, and this is happening, who is responsible? Do all men die? Are all men penalized? You know, how about the man that is the laborer, you know, working? He knows this is going on. When does he stand up and say, no, I will not? That to me gets tough.
Yes, it's more difficult to establish responsibility in a corporate situation, although it's not impossible.
Right.
Okay, who knows? Who has been given responsibility to know these things, and who is making the decisions that it be done? And let's say that we have the guy who owns the corporation in New York, you know, on the day that the plant manager says, we're going to put the contaminants in the air. And one of the implicit or explicit responsibilities laid on the plant manager, you know, through the chain of command, through the president down, is that you do everything which is legal and protect the lives of others. Okay? And so the plant manager makes the decision, kills more children. I would not say the corporation president's to blame. He may bear some financial responsibility because one of his employees was not being reined in, but the employee is the one who made the decision. He'll have to pay the price. Now, let's say the plant manager wants the contaminants to go ahead and be belched out of the plant, but along the way, he's got to tell other people to work the machinery. The people who work the machinery don't necessarily know all the, you know, it's not their obligation to know the social, environmental effects, to know all the legal cases and all that. They're just doing their job. Okay? Now we can reverse the situation. What if the plant manager says, this is really not a good idea to do this? The president says, we've got to get out this load of whatever we're making. You're going to do it anyway. we'll just take the chance that nobody else dies. Then, of course, you see the responsibility has shifted from the plant manager to the corporation president.
Has
it? Well, sure it has. He's the one who made the... Oh, in the sense that the plant manager doesn't have to pay? Okay. No, it hasn't. Because the plant manager knew what would happen. Right. And he would bear responsibility as well. What my point was, in one case, the corporation president is free of guilt, although he may have financial obligation because it's somebody under his employ that has done it. But the other man would be guilty. And the second, they'd both be guilty.
What I was thinking is that, you know, a decision can be made at a board meeting and everyone within the plant knows what, you know, consequences can be. And, you know, everyone has also a choice. You follow that decision, which they, that they are saying is wrong.
Yeah. My guess is in a situation like that, it'd be difficult to establish who in the plant does and does not know the full implications. And therefore, they probably would get away with it, even though, you know, very well some of them shouldn't. But if you can establish that the person working in the plant, just the guy washing the tubs at the other end, knows that the what's going into the air and what he's helping put into the air, well, if you can establish his knowledge and his willing engagement in it, then he's guilty.
I'd like to understand the principle behind the war crimes trial back in the end of the Second World War.
Exactly.
Who has the right to try these men supposedly guilty? Who is ultimately responsible? And under whose ethic are they to be tried? Now, if we carry out what I conceive of to be a consistent principle, can we somehow, through the League of Nations, or United Nations, move into Iran and say, you are guilty of similar type of crimes, and try them on the same basis that we tried those of the Hitler era?
Okay, what standard of justice should be used in a war crimes situation? This is this question, this circumstance scenario, is one of the easiest ways to show the need to endorse the objective law of God as the universal standard of men and nations. If you don't believe that God has revealed a law that binds all men and all nations, I don't think you can answer that question. I don't believe you ever can have people justly condemned for war crimes. But if there is a universal morality that binds all men, and all men know it, and you trust that because of revelation, then you have grounds for condemning such people. What's the machinery for condemning and punishing? That's a tricky one for me. I'm not quite sure how we go about establishing a world court and all the rest. Now, you might say, well, everybody who willingly wants to be part of the world court system then is bound by the world court's decisions. Well, the difficulty is when nations go to war, it's usually those who are bound by the world court over against those that are not. Now, how are you going to punish those who were not bound previous to the war? And so the machinery of international justice is something, it's another one of these things like legal evidence that I simply have not had the time to do a great deal of research and writing on it and needs to be done. Okay, now, once you do have the machinery and you do have your standards, there's also the question, who should be punished for the crimes of a nation in war? Should the peon soldier who was inducted into service and was told you go over there and you shoot these people? I think the answer to that is no. Unless the man knows that he's violating international standards of justice and clearly is in the wrong and does so knowingly. Now, I don't believe many soldiers are in that situation. For instance, somebody in Vietnam tells a group of soldiers to go kill all the, you know, people in this village.
Now you're talking about William Kelly.
I didn't mention the name at all. Yeah, I am talking about, although I'm not talking about the factual merits of the case, because it's another thing that's up in the air. But assume this scenario, that these soldiers are told to go kill women and children, but they know they're fighting in a war where women and children are combatants. Now, they could go there and say, well, we're going to establish whether these are combatant women or children, and then decide to kill them, or we're just going to follow instructions and expect the upper-ups are going to bear responsibility. I'd say, for the most part, in cases of war, you simply have to trust your commanding officer and do what he says. And that's why the commanding officer bears responsibility in a case like that. But it's not inconceivable that you might establish knowledge on the part of the peon soldier, that he knew that he was killing innocent women and children but because of his frenzy or because of his hatred of people who have slanted eyes or what have you, went ahead and killed him anyway. In which case, I would take him to court and I would have him court-martialed. So, I mean, all these are complicated situations, but the people who have corporate responsibility, those who have military responsibility, they're the ones who are going to be taken to court. And underlings will be taken to court and tried only when it's establishable that they knew they were violating international or military standards of justice or what have you. We haven't finished your questions, I realize. Is that what you wanted?
If I may restate it, would you care to comment on the case of where I force a man to work 7 days a week and the Bible mandates a death penalty for that?
I want to be very sure that's what the Bible says. And since I'm not real sure of that situation, if I run an establishment on the Lord's Day, contrary to God's law, and that's a capital crime, it seems to me it's for the sake of the preservation of good order in my society.
I'm appealing to the biblical principle that I or my servant.
Yeah, I know.
I'm even more clear if I force him to break Sabbath.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make it as clear as I can make it. As easy as I feel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's say that law is binding today. The presumption is that it's binding, unless the New Testament says otherwise.
Well, again, if I could make another sentence here, another fact here. The Bible commands us to be a man. And if I force him to work 7 days a week, I'm forcing him to do something non-human, inhuman. God made the Sabbath for man.
Okay.
And if I force him to break Sabbath, I'm forcing him not to be a man. So I could approach that several ways of saying it's still binding.
Sure.
Yeah.
What I want to say about our tendency not to endorse it is, unless there's New Testament evidence contrary to it, for instance, judge no man as to the day. Now, if that does, in fact, take away penal sanctions for that, then that's one matter. I don't think it does. And since it doesn't, if we are hesitant to carry out any sanction against a particular type of crime, that usually is an indicator that we don't conceive of it in the same light that God does. So we must not insist, well, it doesn't seem to me it's all that bad if the guy opens up his supermarket on Sunday, and therefore it would really be wrong to execute him for doing it. Our reasoning ought to be the following, provided it's biblically correct that he ought to be executed, is that man must be a terribly wicked person because God says that's worthy of death.
Or if we close up anything. Are we working on the premise here that that's kid, that this guy's working 7 days a week or that he's working on a Sunday?
I didn't distinguish. I left it open deliberately.
Yeah. Although that is another question, is what do you do in a society where you have people want to observe Friday, Muslims, Saturday, the Jews, and Sunday, the Christians? Well,
to me, Sabbath is can be negotiated. I mean, which is the Sabbath can be settled, but must be studied. I'm teachable on which is the Sabbath.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a moral principle in the law that the Sabbath is made for man, whichever day it is.
Right.
And I cannot force him to be inhuman. But I guess my question was the penalty. You see, I listed the goring of the ox.
All I'm saying is that the penalty shows us what a heinous crime it is.
And we're not talking about first-degree murder, second-degree, third-degree. We're talking about the so-called religious crime again. And everybody would say that's a classic case of a religious crime.
Fine.
So I see it as very moral myself.
Yeah, you're getting at the fact that it's humane to...
It's inhumane.
That's right. Eventually, I'm going to have to get on to the exposition of the Decalogue, so let me just take a few more questions and try to move ahead.
How do you distinguish between the situation where a person's donkey falls in a ditch, okay, and when it is a capital crime? For instance, people have to work in hospitals on Sunday. Mm-hmm. People have to eat. How do you discern the two?
Biblically.
Right. I mean, what's the principle, you know?
Whatever principle is going to have to be judged according to the Bible is what my answer is. Works of necessity, works of mercy, and works of worship are certainly allowed on the Lord's Day, according to the teaching of the Bible. Consequently, people who are in, for instance, I can think of a situation, well, when I went away to school as a college student, I wouldn't have eaten if somebody didn't run the dining commons that day, just like I won't eat if my wife doesn't cook on Sunday, or at least on Saturday or something. So I'm rather helpless when it comes to those things. So, I mean, a work of necessity may be involved there. A work of mercy, helping the sick, the infirm, the fire department, the police, and all that. Then, of course, you're going to come to borderline cases. Keeping the steel mills heated up over the Lord's Day, is that a necessity? In order that, because I'm told that if you let them, you know, cool, that it takes at least a week to heat them, so you're going to have to go over that next Lord's Day. Does that mean we can't have steel mills today? Well, what it means is we need some people who are going to learn to apply the ancient law of God to a modern society. And I haven't got an answer to that question. Although I am willing to say it's better to give up steel than it is to go to hell. So, I mean, I'm not going to be in a position. I'm not going to go in with the attitude, we're going to save the steel mills no matter what. Although I tend to think that we probably can save the steel mills if we do our study and all the rest. Maybe we can't have steel until such a day where you can fire the furnaces faster than is presently the case. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. But you have borderline cases. But the general answer in the church is works of necessity, mercy, and worship are allowed on the Lord's Day. You've been waiting a long time. It's just you're too polite.
You mentioned before that a murderer, even though he's repentant and he isn't murderous, should still turn himself in. But an adulterer, if he repents before he's arrested or anything like that, would have no obligation. But wouldn't he still be an adulterer even though he's not adulterous?
Yes, he would still have been an adulterer, but there's no corpus delicti. There's no outstanding debt to be remitted, restitution made for. There's no body in the street, no embezzled money to be restored, and that sort of thing. I thought you were going to ask the question, well, what if a child has come from this situation? Then what happens? Well, minimally, he owes the support of the child. Does he owe his life? I don't know. I hope you will notice that you've asked me a number of questions, half a dozen or so, as I'm keeping track here in my mind, where the answer is, I don't know. Why don't we know the answer to these questions? Because for years we've been told we don't even have to worry about it. And I'm saying that I'm starting to worry about it, and I just haven't got time to stay up night and day figuring out all the answers. But they've got to be figured out. I'm not saying, well, okay, now let it go. Don't accept that from me. Go home and do your homework. Some of you work in areas that I haven't had time to. There's got to be a division of labor in this matter, you know? But I freely admit that I'm not well trained in the word of righteousness. That if I had exercised my senses, you know, more and more and more, I'd be able to handle some of these questions, but I'm not. But that isn't to say that we aren't under obligation to find answers. Okay, I'm still trying to cut down on the questions to get to the exposition now, so...
I've had a question about the stand of two and Christians who believe that the observance go to rest on them after church. And they expect the restaurant to be open for their Sunday afternoon dinner. And that's always been a little bit of a tension in my mind.
Okay, we're going to come to the Sabbath, Lord willing, during the next hour or so. And so I'm going to put off your question. If you don't mind, I understand the difficulty, but I haven't given any exposition on the Sabbath yet on the basis of which I could answer your questions. Yeah.
You spend some time, sometime before we're through, discussing implementation, other than just saying that you're a voluntarist, maybe?
I'll say just a couple of minutes right now, very quickly. The way this is going to be implemented is, one, we're going to do a lot more evangelism. Two, we're going to do a lot more edification of people. Three, we're going to convince them that there's a Christian world and life view that's worked out in all areas of life. Four, we're going to stop this ungodly antinomianism in the church, what is being taught. Five, we're going to bring up our young people in Christian schools. Six, we're going to encourage men to go into the occupation of lawyers and judges, legislators, and all the rest. And we're going to do a lot of praying. That's the way it's going to be implemented.
What was the snicker when you mentioned? I think that's the most important point that you've mentioned.
That may be.
This morning.
Why don't you go on and say something about that?
Because we become, I'm an old man, so you'll forgive me if I'm judgmental.
And preach wisdom.
But we become hep, as the younger generation says, to certain movements, charismatic movement, so forth and so on. And we've become all, as they say in Kentucky, whole hog for that. And we forget to be holy.
Yeah.
The most definite requirement of a Christian is to be holy. And of course, keeping the law as being holy. That's all I want to say. I want to preach a sermon.
Well, we probably need it. That's okay. Yeah. That's just one of those areas where all sorts of things need to be said. Somebody needs to be writing, you know, a manual of arms for Christians, how we're going to engage in our holy war, you know, with the sword of the Spirit and all the rest. But it's important for me to point out that I'm not talking about revolution. I'm not talking about violating the laws of land. I am talking about sorts of things need to be said. Somebody needs to be writing, you know, a manual of arms for Christians, how we're going to engage in our holy war, you know, with the sword of the Spirit and all the rest. But it's important for me to point out that I'm not talking about revolution. I'm not talking about violating the laws of land. I am talking about edifying Christians so that they know their obligation, will live out their obligation when it comes to the ballot box and influencing their neighbors and all the rest. And until there's this grassroots revival across the board, I don't see much happening. I do not believe in the imposition of law from the top down. I mean, if I were put in a situation where I had to lead a people and I had to make a decision this way or the other, then I would probably say, well, I mean, if one law is going to be imposed on an anarchy situation, then I'm going to choose a better law over against a poor law. But short of anarchy, the way of social reform is to bring it about gradually through the society. That's, by the way, the technical term for that is gradualism. I'm a gradualist. I believe in the infiltration, or if you will, the work of leaven in a society. I'm not a consummationist. I do not believe in, we're just going to come and explode on a society and here it's all going to be, you know. Lo, here the kingdom. But I believe the kingdom comes slowly. First the blade and then the ear and then the full corn. You see, it's going to be a gradual development of sanctification, working out individual lives and then in all of their relationships in society as well. We keep talking about society. You know that we could be talking about the family, the church. All sorts of areas need reform. Just, I guess, the one that's in the news and easy for us to illustrate is society.
I just want to add, you're also not an elitist. This came up in OT1 this year. Okay, let's say it happens voluntaristically. Now, we're going to have a Christian elite, right, that's going to make the laws. You're also not teaching that.
No, I'm not. I believe, I guess it was in another class I said that some, it's all getting blurred right about now. I forget where I said what. But if I had the choice between a man running for office, be it president, senator, what have you, who claimed to be a born-again Christian, but was an antinomian when it came to his social morality, and a man who made no claims to being a Christian, but believed in most of the principles that agree with the law of God with respect to society, I believe my obligation is to vote for the man who doesn't claim to be a Christian, but wants to do what a Christian ought to do in office, rather than a man who claims to be a Christian but won't do what a Christian ought to do in office. Do we understand the difference between these two? What I'm looking for is a man who's going to do what ought to be done. Ideally, that's the man who also claims to be a Christian. But if an unbeliever says he's going to do what ought to be done, then I'm going to vote for an unbeliever. And so I'm not an elitist, that's right.
Just for the sake of summary, get a little more crystallized in my head, what you're saying is then that what needs to go on now is the evangelization of the world or our country, wherever we are in our particular
right.
local situation, and that as more and more people become Christians and appropriate scriptural principles into their lives, we introduce more and more biblical law to the civil magistrate, get them to accept more and more of the biblical law,
right.
and as they implement this, it's kind of a growing gradual.
That's right, exactly right.
And it's we can't really, you're not, as you said, into imposing biblical law onto a non-biblical
no.
society.
No, I'm not. Every society will impose its law on the criminal element in society. That's just because the criminal element won't be subject to the rule of law. But I do not believe in imposing on society as a whole a particular form of law. The society as a whole must endorse it. By the way, even if you weren't a Christian and could see good reason for this, that's the way God would want it done, the fact is you can't make a society that's unwilling to follow a law code follow the law code. Unless you're going to have one soldier for every individual in the society who's going to watch that person day in and day out to make sure he never departs from it. You cannot impose a rule of law. A rule of law must be, in some sense, the conscience of the society as well. And that will only happen if the society is, for the most part, regenerate.
So it seems to me then that there would be a lot less problem the full execution there. Mm-hmm. Even that a lot few people are going to be executed in a Christian regenerate society. And those who are regenerate probably be a little more in agreement with that.
Yeah. I think that's a good observation. Sir?
A while ago, you said that you feared that the church had waited too long to actualize the theonomic position. You were not, in fact, inferring a pessimism into your post-millennial position, were you?
Well, I'm saying whatever pessimism I might or might not have is with respect to my current situation. I'm not pessimistic about the kingdom. The gates of hell are not going to prevail against the kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdom of our Lord. There's no question about it. But there is some question whether it'll happen in my lifetime. The difficulty with many post-millennialists in the past is they tend to have a very early flush of enthusiasm until they find out that these things happen very slowly. And then since it's not going to happen for my benefit, or if you will, so that I can see it in my children's generation, well, then it kind of, you know, gets cold, or you get pessimistic and you change your eschatology. Well, I trust God will save me from that by His grace, changing my eschatology on the basis of what I read in the newspaper. I'm not sure what the outcome in my generation is going to be. I do have some pessimism, but I have no question as to what the church is going to do in the long run. By the way, I don't hesitate to say that we're still in the infant days of the church. I don't know if we are, but there's nothing in the Bible to indicate that we're living in the last days. Unless you use the term last days in the general sense of the whole period between the advents of Christ, then of course it's the last days. But whether we're in the more common sense living right toward the end of the age, I have no way of knowing. And there's no reason at all why we couldn't still be living in what is just going to be the most infantile period of the church. You see that growth we've made in the last 2,000 years? That's just the beginning of what lies ahead. Now, if you can talk that way, and then you can understand that I think there might be a dip in the valley on this upward, you know, emerging of the kingdom. But I'm not going to give up my post-millennialism, as far as I can see, just because I'm not sure of my generation. Remember, my pessimism wasn't a pessimism that dictates policy. All I'm saying is that I'm worried that we've waited too long. Let me talk about abortion just for a minute. I'm of the socio-political opinion, descriptively, that the only way we're going to stop the abortion epidemic in this country is with a constitutional amendment. Well, I mean, I can almost tell you legally, because the Supreme Court has supported abortion, that until the laws change, the Supreme Court has already interpreted the law as we now have it. So we have to have a change of law. I also think that the abortion epidemic and the mentality of abortion, which is even worse, the mentality that justifies abortion, it's my body, I can do what I want, that mentality will not live with the imposition of a law saying, no, you can't do whatever you want with your body. And so I just don't know what's going to happen when these two irresistible forces hit each other. Because a Christian population will not put up with it, unless it's going to become like the Lutheran Church in Hitler's day. But right now, there's evidence the Christian Church is going to rise up against this. And when the Church brings about, hopefully, a constitutional amendment against it, what's going to be the social result? I don't know. Historically, the answer has been civil war. I'm not sure how we're going to live together when we have two absolutely diverse moral codes being lived and all the rest. Because we're very quickly getting beyond the realm of civil and rational dispute on the matter. It's becoming a matter of who has the power to impose what. And it has to in some sense, because Christians can't forever, you know, stand around saying, well, let me try to dissuade you from abortion. The day must come where we say we're going to stop this ungodly infanticide. And on the other hand, people who want it aren't going to stick around waiting 9 months to dispute the issue. They're going to want to abort their children as soon as they can. And so I just humanly don't know what the answer is to that. So that's what I meant, that I'm afraid the church may have waited too long. But being afraid the church has waited too long is not going to stop me from preaching against abortion and doing everything I can and encouraging a constitutional amendment. Okay, I don't see any hands. We'll cut off questions, and I'm going to go to an exposition of the law of God for the last hour anyway. And I suppose what I had better do is keep a good eye on the final exam, because in my exposition, if I don't touch on some of these questions, then I'd have to drop some of the questions from the final exam.
There you go.
Any more questions?
Yeah. I already cut off the questions before I said that.
I have a sermon.
Now they want the sermon. Okay. Yeah, I think I can say something about each of those that are on there. Would you like to negotiate dropping some of the questions? It's the most enthusiastic thing I've heard in the whole class. Well, we'll talk about it when we get down to the end. At the end of the hour, I'll talk to you about what your obligations are going to be.
Would you cover the 38? That to me is very crucial in so many areas of life.
Okay. I have my notes, and I'm just passing them up. I want you to at least know an area that you could research if you're going to, and that's the whole question of the Decalogue itself, the character of the Decalogue, its uniqueness in the corpus of law in the Old Testament, its function in the Old Testament, and so forth. There, I have an introduction to the Decalogue that talks about a lot of these things. That in itself is a fascinating study, not the particular question of what the Decalogue requires, but just the character of the Decalogue, its function, its place, and all the rest in the covenant. But let's go to the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. What is the positive requirement of the first commandment? Before I get into this, let me just tell you, this is the place that if we would have had 2 or 3 weeks, what you usually do in the Reformed exposition of the law is each one of these commandments amounts to an area of our moral obligation. Okay, so now what we do is we exposit the law and we come down to, let's say, the sixth commandment, which says you shall not kill, and that then you see will become the jumping off place for discussing all the questions bearing on the taking of life, okay? Obviously, taking a life in the general sense. The distinction between manslaughter and murder, a question of abortion, a question of genetic engineering, a question of racial reconciliation, ecology, and so forth. Okay? So that's generally the way the Reformed churches have exposited the law, and there's a reason for that. I'm not going into it. But it turns out, well, I will a little bit. Each one of the commandments is a way of looking at the whole of our moral duty. Each one of the commandments tends to cover all the other commandments. Let's ask ourselves how that is. Eighth commandment forbids stealing. What is stealing? Taking away or depriving someone of their lawful due. What is God's lawful due? What do we owe to God? All of our lives. Therefore, anytime we sin, which is taking away from what we owe God, we are stealing from God. And so every sin is a form of stealing. You understand that reasoning? The Bible follows that reasoning, by the way. Covetousness is called idolatry, the book of Colossians. How is that? Well, there's a perspective that each one of the commandments gives us. We shall not take the Lord's name in vain. What is it to bear the name of the Lord? So we are owned by the Lord, we hold His testimonies and His word, and therefore every time we sin, we are taking His name, we are lifting up His name, using that which has His name upon it vainly, in an improper way. Every sin is taking the Lord's name in vain. Okay? No other gods before me. Every time we sin, we're putting something above the living and true God, aren't we? We have a priority that is being evidenced that says God comes second. Every sin is a violation of the first commandment. Now, it turns out with each and every one of the Ten Commandments, you can do that. Every commandment's a perspective on the whole. And yet every commandment has its distinctive emphasis. It's, if you will, unique area of life it's covered. Sexual purity, economic purity, purity with respect to how we relate to each other in society in terms of violence and that sort of thing. The purity of our time, the purity of respect for authority, all the rest. So each commandment has its distinctive emphasis. Each commandment covers the whole. And that's why we exposit the law in this way. That's why we use this as a pedagogical device for expositing the law. But now let me just do some very quick exposition of a few commandments for you. Try to pick up at least some interesting questions along the way for answer.
no other gods before me, the first commandment. What is the demand of the first commandment, the positive requirement? It's a demand for exclusive covenant loyalty. We are to have no other sovereign but God himself. He requires that we acknowledge only his lordship, exclusive lordship in our lives. And in the treaty form of the Old Testament, this is the requirement of devoted love. Deuteronomy 6:5, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. This is the first and great commandment. As such, it's the overall framework and a summary of all the other commandments. So that's its positive requirement. What is negatively required? What is prohibited by this commandment? Well, it requires separation from false gods and the practitioners of idolatrous or false religion. Look at 2 Corinthians 6:14-18. That separation is still required today of God's people. Separation from all false practitioners of idolatry or false religion. 2 Corinthians 6:14. Be not unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what fellowship have righteousness and iniquity? Or what communion have light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what portion hath a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For we are a temple of the living God, even as God said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come ye out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch no unclean, and I will receive you. And I will be to you a father, and you shall be to me sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. Of course, the separation that God is requiring of us in the first commandment does not pertain to every single aspect of life or separation in every conceivable way. In 1 Corinthians 5:9, Paul says, I wrote unto you in my epistle to have no company with fornicators, not at all meaning with the fornicators of this world or with the covetous and extortioners, or with idolaters, for then ye needs must go out of the world. Paul says, I'm not asking that you be raptured. And I'm not asking that you be separate in that physical sense from the covetous and idolaters and fornicators. But your separation is a moral, spiritual separation. You are to be separate in one way, but not in another. What is absolutely prohibited is a common religious venture with an unbeliever. Okay, what is the broad scope of the commandment? This is my third point. Positive requirement, negative requirement, now the broad scope. The broad scope of this commandment has to do with worship. A God is a being who is by nature worshipped. And the true God is that being which is deserving of worship. And so we are not to worship creatures, Romans 1:25. We are not to worship angels, Revelation 22:9. And we are not to worship men, Acts 14:15. I know I'm going fast, and you know why, so forgive me. But in Romans 12:1, worship indicates also service. Romans 12:1, our spiritual service. And since worship includes service, worship then bears on all aspects of life. If that's true, then what the first commandment's requiring is total consecration of our lives to God. Total consecration. And that's why in James 1:27, I dare not take the time to read it, in James 1:27, true worship is identified with what? Singing the right kinds of songs and having the right kind of preaching? True worship is avoiding the world and serving the widows. That's true worship of God. Isn't the way we usually think of it, but if you understand the first commandment, that's obvious. True worship is the way we serve God throughout our lives. And if that's the case, then all sin is idolatry. All sin is a violation of the first commandment. Yeah, that was my third point, the broad scope of the commandment. Now let's look at the particular focus, the unique aspect of the first commandment. What does the first commandment say about the occult today? Anything from Satanism to transcendental meditation to karate even. And, if you understand karate in its full world and life form implications. Well, obviously the fact that we have to talk about the occult, Satanism, TM, karate, or all the rest, shows that our evangelism is incomplete. That's obvious. But Scripture goes beyond this and it says that we are forbidden to worship demons, and we are forbidden to hearken to diviners. Leviticus 19:31, Leviticus 20, verses 6 and 27, Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 to 14. Let me just read one of these. I'll read Leviticus 20, verses 6 and 27. And the soul that turneth unto them that have familiar spirits, and unto the wizards, to play the harlot after them, I will even set my face against that soul, and will cut him off from among his people. Verse 27, a man also or a woman that hath a familiar spirit, or that is a wizard, shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones, their blood shall be upon them. We are forbidden to hearken to diviners. The Bible tells us that they have no power over us. Indeed, we can resist Satan and he must flee. They are not genuine gods. We are not to listen to the demons and those who follow the demons. So the Bible has some very strict words to speak about the occult. This is not an area for playing with Ouija boards, you see, or showing toleration for astrology or all the rest. There's a question, should a Christian read his horoscope in the daily paper? Well, religiously, no. Scientifically, perhaps. What if somebody wants to say, well, let's establish scientifically whether there's anything to this? Well, to study it, you're going to have to read it. But to read your horoscope as though that had anything to say, and even the attitude that says, well, I don't really think there's anything to it, but I mean, what's it hurt to look? The Bible forbids. Hearken not to the diviners, to the astrologers. How about secret societies? We're working now. I'm going to go so fast, I'm going to lose you. Okay, the first point was the positive requirement of the law. The second point was the negative requirement. The third was the broad scope. And the fourth is the particular application, the first of which was the occult. Secondly, what about secret societies? For example, the Masonic Lodge. And I know that the Masons are very big in a lot of different places, and I'm not intending to step on toes, but I have to be true to my God, and so let me say a few things. Masonic teaching, for all of the good that individual Masons show, Masonic teaching says that it is, quote, the essence of all religions. The essence of all religions. And therefore, it assumes that there is a natural morality and a lowest common denominator unifying all religions. If there is a natural morality and a lowest common denominator, then Christ is not necessary and the way of salvation is suppressed. That makes it a false religion, even though it claims to honor the Christian religion. And even though many Masons are Christians. But I mean, a lot of us are inconsistent, and so that inconsistency doesn't change what I'm saying. We are not to encourage false gods, the Bible says. And Scripture never favors a common religious morality apart from the law or revelation of God. And therefore, I think Christians ought to preach against membership in secret societies such as Masons. Let's push a little bit further. How about public schools? We're talking about separating from all religious idolatry. Okay? The occult, secret societies. How about public schools? I don't have time to do all the putting the Novocaine in. I'm going to go right to the cut. When public schools require teaching from a humanist ideological perspective, public schools are teaching a false religion. When Christian distinctives and presuppositions are restricted and neutrality is required, and neutrality is a sin in the Bible, then public schools are teaching a false religion. The Bible itself, contrary to many popular opinions, has an educational morality. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Deuteronomy 6 tells us that all education flows from a religious commitment and is to be based on God's revelation and is to be under the control of the parents. I could say much more, but just that by way of whetting your appetite, there is an educational morality in the Bible. I do not believe it is sinful under all circumstances for a Christian to have his parents. Sometimes our parents need to go back to school. But our children in public schools. I can imagine circumstances under which you have no option, or where sometimes the public schools, ironically, are not as dangerous as some of the Christian schools in town. I don't want to go into all those odd, extreme circumstances. But as a general rule, it is a violation of the First Commandment to have your children in public schools where they're being taught a humanistic religion. How about denominations? What about compromise in denominations that are not teaching the Word of God? You asked for this class. Now, I mean, if it's getting a little tight, I'm sorry. But the First Commandment requires separation from those that are teaching false religions. No other gods before me, not even in education, not even in your secret societies, and not even in your churches. I'm going to at least ask this question. Does the Christian have the freedom to be a member of a denomination where unbelievers and heretics minister and teach without discipline? There's quite a difference between a church that disciplines its unbelievers and heretics and a church that says, well, there's nothing we can do about it. And so makes the church into a mission field rather than a missionary agency. Does a Christian have the right to be a member of a denomination where unbelievers and heretics minister and teach without discipline, or where heinous sins such as abortion are not disciplined but actually financed? What does the First Commandment require about your denominational affiliation if it says you shall have no other gods before me? How about cooperative evangelism? Fifth area. Does the First Commandment allow a union of effort between Christ-denying participants and Christ-worshipping participants in an evangelistic rally? Does the First Commandment allow the following rationale? If we allow the local bishop to come down and open with prayer, even though we're dead set in our conviction that he needs to be converted, nevertheless, he'll bring a lot more of his liberal people with him that need to hear the gospel, and therefore we will cooperate with his church in our evangelistic effort. No other gods before me. Of course, even among evangelical Christians, there are going to be degrees of involvement, allowed or disallowed, depending upon the perceived orthodoxy of those with whom you're cooperating. Can very strong Calvinists evangelize with very strong Arminians? I'm not talking about, is it conceivable they could get along? I'm saying, is it right if they hold their convictions firmly to engage in a cooperative effort of evangelism when in fact their conception of the gospel is radically different? Well, is their conception of the gospel radically different? That's something you have to ask and all the rest. Right now, what I'm doing is encouraging you to ask yourself some questions, if nothing else. What does the First Commandment require of you? What does the Second Commandment require? God says you shall have no graven images. First question is, how is this distinctive from the First Commandment? Well, the distinctive thrust of the Second Commandment is not against artwork. The Second Commandment is not against artwork. Obviously, the temple in the Old Testament is an enduring testimony that God enjoys good art and wants good art to be performed and produced. But the Second Commandment is against homage paid to images as representations of deity. Specifically, mind you, representations of the true God. You see, the First Commandment rules out doing anything with respect to false gods. The Second Commandment has to do with religious images pertaining to the true God. Granted, it also rules out religious images of false gods, but we've already gotten rid of false gods over here on the First Commandment. The Second Commandment's going on through the worship of the true God, and what it's saying over against the First Commandment is don't make any graven images of him. The Second Commandment is forbidding any media through which God draws near to man. Any media through which God draws near to man, or it's thought that he does so. What are the grounds for this commandment? What's the reason for the commandment? Look at Deuteronomy 4, 15 and following when you get time. The answer is, God was invisible. There was no image seen upon the mount. Because God was invisible, you do not have the right to make an image of God. Secondly, God has a living personality versus the idols which are not alive and have no power. Thirdly, respect for the creation structure demands that we make no graven images of God. What is the creation structure? There is the lower creation, the immediate creation, and then the epitome of creation. What is the epitome of creation?
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.